when I discussed this with Chip, that he was mentioning that, you know, we've got to talking about it, and there was work on done, and there was another called the Minkowski Island antenna that I brought up. There was some writings about the Minkowski Island antenna, which basically, you know, was trying to get around loop antennas. In other words, taking the loop antenna and twisting it. And Minkowski came up with this idea that he could rearrange a loop antenna into another shape and still get it to basically fall into the laws, or I should say, Krauss and Maxwell's work, Dick, over.
Okay. Lots and lots of people think that a cubical quad type Yagi is going to have a hell of a lot more gain than a dipole like Yagi. And all of a sudden I'm having trouble remembering the call letters of the guy in the San Diego area. K6Y, he doesn't know. I'm having trouble thinking of his call letters and name right now. But this is the guy who invented the Quaggy antenna way back in the 70s. And he did a fairly exhaustive research of cubical quad versus dipole. And did somebody just give me those call letters?
Yeah, Mike Stoll, K6MY6.
Good guess, no. Mike Stoll had the company called KLM. And no, he's not the guy I'm trying to think of, even though he's in the exact same area.
I mean, Wayne Overbeck, M6MB.
You got it. K6YNB, as he was. But Wayne Overbeck is the name. You got it, Rich. Well done. The Quaggy antenna. But cubicle quads, people used to think it's really a, you know, one Yagi stacked above the other, and you're going to get more gain out of it. The answer is not really. Again, I keep coming back to maybe there's a little bit of difference in a two-element quad versus a two-element Yagi. But when you start getting significant effective capture area, like a 10-element Yagi, I know there is no difference in gain between dipole, loop, triangle, square, cubical quad, whatever. The Yagi phenomena is a resonant parasitic structure, a series of them, with the right resonant frequency in the right position in space, being fed with a dipole-like driven element, or maybe even a log periodic version of them. So the exact shape almost doesn't matter. That gives you a lot of freedom to use the materials that are available, make it aesthetically more pleasing, bend it around all kinds of crazy ways. I think this is a little bit about what you're talking about. Now, when you talk to Chip Cohen on these various antennas, I am curious, how long ago was that conversation? Looks like he's a really big HFDXer, not too much of a VHF, UHF man, from what I can tell with his biography at QRZ.com. How long ago did you talk to him, Mel? It sounds like you and he had quite a conversation. During the time I was interfacing with him professionally, I sent him a bunch of emails. And maybe I made them too long, included too many questions or whatever. I didn't get answers. But on the air, on HF frequencies, it sounds to me like you got lots of answers. How long ago was that, Mel? K2RIW?
This is K2KEY. No, this was not on the air I spoke to him. This was talking to him about a business deal, Dick, representing a customer at the time that was interested in an antenna for a specific use. It had to be an antenna that didn't look really like an antenna. I basically got attracted to practice because some of them looked like some intricate ironwork on a building that was part of the design of the, the aesthetics of the building. But as you said, the log periodic, now originally if you go back to this, really, you want to really understand fractal. If you go back to the original, I believe, was a guy by the name, what is the name, Duhamel, Isbell. I've got to search my... Boy, I am getting really senior moments, so I can't come up with these names. I believe they came up with the original log periodic. And basically, if you look, it was so hard to understand the log periodic, basically. But if you look at a log periodic, it basically was the fractal type of what's known as the fractal tooth design stick, over.
Yeah, I think you could find a relationship there, Bruckmill. Log periodic seemed to me to get popular in the late 50s, early 60s, is when they seemed to come along, and there was a number of IEEE conferences on antennas of a log periodic-like structure. And there's a lot of variations on a log periodic-like structure. Some of them are almost three-dimensional looking things, volumetric antennas, as opposed to a planar antenna. The good news about a log is it's one approach to getting a lot of frequency bandwidth. To make a log that works from 20 megacycles to 200 megacycles inclusive, relatively easy. And to have no more than 2.5 to 1 viswire across all of that. And depending on how you build it, you can probably get 8 dB over isotropic of gain across most of that frequency range. So it gives you a lot of performance. I wouldn't call the usual zigzag design of a whole lot of tapered elements that constitutes a conventional log periodic, I wouldn't quite call it fractal. It doesn't quite have step and repeat. I mean, the real fractal design, when it's a second, third, fourth, fifth order, has a particular element, triangle, square, diamond, whatever, that's repeated a whole lot of times in a particular characteristic way. But it's the exact same size element, stepped and repeated. Whereas log periodic, all of the elements are different in size. It really is tapered. So I don't see a huge relationship between classic log periodic and fractal. But maybe you'll convince me. Over to you, Mel, KQLAW.
Roger, this is KQKEY. Well, what I'm going by, if you look at Kraus, 1985, in his book, Kraus's book, he shows one of the first log periodic antenna sticks, and they actually describe this exact word as a spiral fractal stick. Over.
Okay. Was this a spiral-like, circular polarized log periodic you're talking about? The thing where the radiating element is laid on the surface of a cone? Go ahead.
Yes, basically, it was a coaxial connection, and if you look at the way he... No, you got to look the way he diagrammed it. How did he sketch out this log periodic? He didn't sketch it out like you would think he sketched it out. It looks like, well, I could say, you got to look in the book under it. On Krauss's book on 1985, I remember looking at that distinctly because it is a unusual diagram of a antenna, something that you don't see really in any part of the other part of the book. How he explains the ground plane effect, Dick, over.
So it's a log periodic with ground plane. We're not talking about a helical-like antenna, a quad helix, or a log periodic taper helix. When you said the word ground plane, I'm a little bit confused because most log periodics don't have a ground plane. Now back to you, Mel.
He only introduces the log periodic as a with a ground plane, I guess you call it a ground plane structure. I'm just taking it off the top of my head. I'd have to find the book and everything like that. But you'd have to look at it. It's like they say, a picture's worth a thousand words. And this is exactly the only way I can describe it. Like I say, I remember distinctly in Krauss's book how he described that, and it was actually described as a spiral fractal. So actually, if you want to look at a log periodic, we actually were a step away from generalizing to maybe not all fractal antennas, but going in that direction. What do they call that? Basically, the fractal antenna had a special called an harmonic resonance of, I believe they refer to it as Chip, I think, described it as the, I believe he used the word an AN harmonic resonance to stick over.
Similar to the word anechoic, almost non-resonant. Well, antennas of reasonably high performance, I'm convinced, must resonate on each of the frequencies where you use them. Because the theory I keep saying over and over again, the mantra, is when it comes to a wavelength-sized antenna, and I say that to differentiate between traveling wave structures like a rhombic or beverage, these things that are a zillion wavelengths long. I'm not talking about that kind of antenna, but when it comes to an antenna that is half wave, one wave, or whatever, wavelength-sized antenna, it is a standing wave structure. Resonance takes place. The signal traveling down that antenna, you'd like it to just jump into space. It doesn't do that. Only a couple of percent of the energy jumps into space on the first pass. Therefore, the energy is going to bounce back and forth in the antenna lots and lots of times. That's what makes it a standing wave structure. And the word resonate means that you're making sure that all of those bounces stay co-phased, that they all add together and complement each other. And the reason you do that, you can look at it from two or three different ways. One way is that only 1% of the energy or so gets radiated on each pass, so it takes a whole lot of passes to finally radiate the energy. That's one way of looking at it. Another way of looking at it, let me drop, is that you are, by forcing resonance, you have created a finite Q, Quebec Q. Q means you're getting a certain voltage rise at resonance or a certain current rise at resonance, the current rise you want, because there's the current flowing through the antenna, and you like that current to be as high as possible somewhere in the antenna. That current flowing through the antenna creates a magnetic field by Lenz's law. The current creates a magnetic field. The magnetic field is what gets radiated. Not one single electron, per se, leaves your antenna. It's the magnetic field that leaves your antenna that radiates into space. And you want the magnetic field to be as strong as possible. Therefore, you want the current to be as strong as possible. Therefore, you want resonance to increase the current. That's one way of looking at what's going on with most of these structures. Now, the AN resonant antenna implies non-resonance. And I think it's a slight misuse of the word. Because without resonance, you're not getting current rise. Without current rise, you're not getting efficient radiation. A good fractal-like structure has multiple ways of resonating. You could say it is AN resonant, meaning that as you sweep across the frequency, you don't see one frequency of resonance and non-resonance everywhere else. But I think about the fractal is it's got a whole lot of individual paths for the signal to flow through. Therefore, depending on what frequency it's on, it chooses the right path to find resonance. Your fan dipole does that. Your fan dipole has a whole lot of resonating frequencies. Only the one that resonates, but of the fans, you've got five different fan dipoles together, and you're on frequency number four. The fourth dipole is the one that resonates and sucks up the energy. The log periodic has a whole lot of various size dipole-like structures, and the signal propagates down the zigzag transmission line of the log periodic antenna until it finds the dipole of resonance, and the energy goes into that one and radiates. So, and resonance would apply in non-resonance. There's still resonance. There's just multiple resonances by the complicated structure. That's my way of looking at it. K2KEY, K2LAW.
This is K2KEY. All right, let's back up 1 minute. Let's discuss what is a log periodic. Now, let me make a statement what I think a log periodic is, and you correct me. Listen carefully, because it's very important, because I've heard a number of people describe log periodics, and I put them together in my head with an interest to find out really what is a log periodic. The word log periodic, I think, refers to the reason that the ratio of spacing and element sizes are periodically distributed so that there has a comparison of any one with the next biggest Yeah, next biggest one will always provide a constant. I think that is basically what a log periodic is. That the reason the antennas are log periodic is because the ratio of the spacing and the elements are periodically distributed, so the comparison of one with the next biggest one is always the constant. Am I correct, Dick? Over.
I agree with you. There is a constant of a step and repeat-like mathematical function. When you compare the spacing of the first element and the length of the first element to the spacing and the length of the next element, there's a constant offset. And in some of the designs, that constant is not a simple arithmetic constant. It's an exponential constant. And once you get into exponential constants, you can be using a logarithmic or an anti-logarithmic exponential constant. So the constant is not just a constant multiply. You know, each element is not 10% bigger than the next one, and each spacing is not 10% bigger. It's a little more exotic than that. So without a doubt, there is a kind of a constant, but in some cases, I think it's an exponential constant. Back to you, Mel.
Okay, you brought up a very good point. Excellent. Okay, let's say that the ratios are constant. Then the log ratio would give a constant difference, correct?
You got it. So if I took the log of each one of the lengths, or the log of each one of the spacings, I believe that would be the exact same constant from element to element. That's what I believe is the origin of the word log and periodic. Back to you, Mel.
Roger, you have it right, except that we must always remember that the ratio being constant in the design of the log antenna, but the, because of the log of the ratios giving a constant, actually a difference. See, you got to put the word difference. Otherwise, you don't have actually the logarithmic part. You can't have the logarithmic part without the difference, Dick. Over.
I'm going to agree with that. Now, log periodics are very handy antennas when you've got to cover a lot of frequency. That's the good news. On most HF frequencies, they do take up quite a lot of real estate. And as a rotatable antenna on HF frequencies, very few amateurs have put up one. The FAA puts them up at their various sites. They've got the real estate. They've got the resources to build an antenna that's 80 feet long in boom length, and the biggest element is 95 foot long, and it covers 6 to 35 megacycles, all of the possible overseas frequencies that are ever used for long range communication to their aircraft, on the assumption that they need the backup just in case a satellite system fails. My guess is almost all of the communication these days with overseas aircraft is done by satellite. So these log periodic antennas that you'll see like sitting out in front of MacArthur Airport, they're kind of a holdover. I don't think very many new installations are putting those up anymore. But that antenna does cover something like 6 to 35 megacycles, maybe 6 to 40. And so whatever the state of the ionosphere is, in those days, you could choose a frequency, pump it into your log periodic, aim it in the right direction, and talk to your aircraft that's 5,000 miles away from you. That's what I think was going on. And when it comes to setting up wider antennas, where you've got enough trees in the property, we even set up a catenary of strings or ropes and string these elements between them, sort of like the vertical risers you've got on the Verrazano Narrows Bridge. You can string your elements like that, and in one direction you can make a very high-gain log periodic antenna, just that it's not rotatable. So log periodics have got a lot of good performance. Back to you, Mel. KQRIW.
Yeah, Roger, this is K2KEY. Well, again, how does the word fractal creep into it? I think that, the fractal antenna, it does have a place. I know Chip, he came out with a design, I know one I had seen for 6 meters, And I know the ones for 2 meters, I believe he called them the M series, if I remember correctly. And he had them, he had them basically, I don't know how much in production they were, but he was measuring those fractal antennas basically over a reference quad element. I think that's where his reference came. In other words, he used a single quad element and then produced the fractal antennas and seemed to say that the fractal antenna, ratio of the quad versus the fractal was greater with the fractal. I don't know if that was really a valid testicle.
Yeah, I hear you. Almost doesn't matter. By the way, when you keep referring to the Krauss book, you're probably talking about Krauss's book called Antennas, and there's 3 editions of that. Krauss also has another book, which is a book intended for RF electronic engineering at the college level. I can't remember the name of his book. Electromagnetics, I think it's called. Both very good books. And I believe he's a silent key now. WHJK, Whiskey Alpha, Whiskey 8, Julia Kilo, I think was his call letters. He is the inventor of the helix antenna. That lazy H-like antenna, whatever it's, I forget what it's called, I think he's the inventor of that one. He did a lot of work at the radio telescope setup in Miamisburg, Ohio, I think it was. And I visited that particular site. Beautiful radio telescope, the so-called Big Ear, which recently got taken apart because the land was sold. But he did some very good radio astronomy work. I think the first real radio astronomy map of the sky was done by Ohio University, John Krauss in particular, and his students and co-workers. So he's done some real good work. Forgot where I was going to go with this, and bear in mind that you and I eventually have to get to the mailbag. And by the way, I've been hearing today that there's a particular mysterious person who has been going incognito, but you and I know him very well, sending letters to your mailbag. KTUY, KTUYW.
Roger, this is KTUY. I got many of them. I'll talk to you some other time about that. All right, the one I'm referring to is Krauss's antenna book, J. Krauss, Antennas, 1985, Dick. That's the book I have. I have it here. I have a few of them. I have 90, let's see, what have I got? I got Krauss's antennas, 1950, and then I got a 1985 edition, Dick. Do you have the 85 edition over?
I think I do. I believe that's the second edition. His first edition was McGraw-Hill 1950. His second edition, I think, was 85. His third edition, I think, was somewhere around 1998 or so. And I believe I've got all 3 editions. So tell me roughly where in the book to look for the thing you're talking about. And unfortunately, that particular bookcase is in the other end of the house. I won't easily get there right now. Tell me where to look, and I'll look for the thing you're looking for. Back to you, Mel.
Okay, I remember in the 1985 version of it, that's, I have the first edition, as you said, is 1950. Oh, this was the 1985. Shook hands with this man many a time. I remember, I got to remember, you know, where it was in the book. It was, I think it was the first log periodic. That's what it was called. Dick, that's exactly, you look under the index, you'll see. Look under the first periodic, first log antenna. First log antenna, 1985, Dick, over.
Okay, when I get a chance, I'll look that one up. And so, by the way, now I know at roughly mile marker number 4, you were heavily involved in the communications for the New York City Marathon. Give us a little bit of a rundown. What was it like? I think you couldn't complain about the weather. I think it was about the right temperature to keep everyone happy. And maybe even the wind was right. So what was the New York City Marathon like, radio operator? Back to you, Mel.
Hey, Dick, get the final word on fractal. Also, if you ever get a chance, I want you to look up Landstoffer. I think it was Landstoffer. Yeah, L-A-N-D-S. L-A-N-D-S. How do you spell his last name? C-O-F-E-R, I think. Landstoffer. And look up his thing on weird wire stick. I wonder if you ever got a chance to look at that. And look at some of the Yagis that he came up with. And he claims that by bending these Yagis elements in a crazy way, that's why I would like you to look and get some input from you on this. And he's claiming that it increases it, the Yagis by bending elements, and you get a 3 dB increase in at least on a Yagi by bending the elements over?
No way in hell. Lots and lots of people have written articles like that saying it. I have spent the last, 5.5 years of my life, almost every single day, tuning UHF Yagi-like structures on a well-calibrated network analyzer on an antenna range. Almost every day of my life for the last 5 years, working for a particular client, that's what I'm doing. And from that, I've got a gut feel of what you can really squeeze out of a Yagi and gain and very low standing wave ratio, high efficiency performance. And a number of those patents have my name on them. So I'm convinced that no matter how you make each individual parasitic resonator of a Yagi, doesn't matter what its shape is, how you zigzag it, doesn't matter. It has a certain electronic resonant frequency. It has a certain phase center, each individual parasitic element. It has a certain position in three-dimensional space. You make an array of those, light them all up with a dipole-like driven element, and out comes the directivity, out comes the gain, and if you're smart enough, out comes the bandwidth of low standing wave ratio. But if you think you're going to suddenly get some kind of a super directivity phenomena, super gain phenomena, by changing the shapes of the elements of a already well-designed Yagi, you've got to be careful now. I can easily start off with a Yagi of a poor design, where it's got strong side lobes, lousy front-to-back ratio, and whatever. Bend the elements in some kind of a way that I now move in the direction of a well-designed Yagi, and say see an increase in gain. And I could say the way I bent the elements, let me drop, I could say the way I bent the elements is where the gain is coming from. Well, you got a lousy reference. If I start off with a poor performance Yagi design, and then bending the elements, it brings it into the resonant frequencies of the parasitic elements, it's now a good Yagi design with good positioning, I can say the bending did it. Well, I could also at the same time paint the tips of the antenna with red paint and say the red paint did it. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Hey, this is K2KEY. The only reason I bring that up because there was an expedition, and I happened to see the antenna or pictures of this expedition. That was a 3Y0 expedition to St. Peter's One Island. And they had an unusual antenna there, and I said, what in the God's name was that? I thought maybe the weather, you know, did some work on this antenna. And it was a 20-meter beam, and it had bends in the elements or something, and then when I found out later on, it was intentionally done because according to the bends of these elements, they picked up 3 to 4 dB. Now they claim that, and that's it. And that's why if you ever get a chance, I would like you to look at this weird wires or what this guy Landstoffer did. And the antennas he provided them, and how they claimed that there was definite, there was a phenomenal work that he did on it. Landstoffer, I remember that. Land Stalker. Weird wires, Dick. Over.
Okay, I'm going to search that one down. Maybe I'll do it while you're opening the mailbag.
Okay, Roger. This is K2KEY. Now, okay. New York City Marathon. I was at the marathon today, as you said. Mile 4, a number of other people. We had a nice turnout of people, 39,000 that were running. I'm unofficially running because there were people running the opposite way for some reason. And it was quite an event. Of course, you have to look really at what humanity in some of the worst situations can overcome. And I particularly pay attention to when we have the initial race begin. With these are people that have some kind of physical, situation that they have in life or gone through. People without limbs, people that are severely handicapped in a number of different ways. And the test is kind of a marathon by easy using. You should see, on some of these contraptions, there was one gentleman, let me let it drop. He actually had what looked like a bed spring on wheels. This is the only way I can describe it. He was laying almost perfectly flat. His head was slightly tilted up. And he was driving this thing with an overhead chain type of device. Some of the other people had similar hand-driven situations, but they were able to sit upright. This person, as I understand, cannot actually stand upright at all. He has a frozen, I believe they call it a frozen spine, that they do a certain type of technique to freeze the spine under certain situations where you either you're going to be confined for the rest of your life in a wheelchair or in a actually accept a standing position. And to lay down, he actually has to have a special contraption where he stands up against it and is tilted by remote control or by a motorized device. And they came up with a piece of device like this that you lay on it, and the hand pedal is way down the course, Dick, and how he navigated with this thing is immensely unbelievable with how he twisted the thing that he put, that he's, moving this device by, this hand-driven device, and moving it left and right to keep him on course, over.
Which really says that the word handicap is not easy to describe anymore. Here's a person who can't run on his own feet, supposedly a handicapped person, but with the right kind of implementation, he can overcome an awful lot of those. I can see how the chain drive connected to his arms would supply the power. I am curious as to how he simultaneously did the steering, if you happen to know that.
Okay, I was able to take a quick look at it because it was such a, unusual thing to see. The chain drive in the center had a cable on each side. And the cable, when he moved his arm either way, that actually, in other words, it was controlling the direction by pulling a cable which controlled the front wheel stick, over.
Okay, a cable on each side, but is he taking the hand crank and tilting it left and right to steer the wheels? Or what part of his body is steering? I presume his arms are supplying the power into the hand-operated pedals, but what does he do the steering to operate those two cables?
Well, it seemed like how they did it. The thing that was propelling him forward, the drive, the chain drive, had was able to move left or right. In other words, he could actually give it a little twist. This took a lot of coordination to work out that not only is he propelling this thing by this hand operation, but he's got to also move this thing right and left so that this cable assembly could actually move the wheels either right or left stick. It was quite a contraption, over.
Okay. That's one unusual guy. I bet you there was a whole lot of other unusual people. You get people who run backwards. You get people who run in the past with crazy outfits. You get people who run with a tray of food, a tray of drinks. People with their uniform from their place of business where they serve food. I bet you saw quite a few of those combinations. Is that true?
Yes, I guess you've seen a lot of everything. First of all, people from every part of the world. I understand it was 100 countries that were there. A number of people stopped to talk to me that had come back. One couple had stopped to ask me a couple of questions. They came from Brazil. They had somebody that was running in the race, and they came, actually made a trip from Brazil just to cheer them on. You know, everybody's cheering somebody on from the sidelines. Yes, there were people. Now, there was one unusual person that was running. He had no legs. He looked like he was running on giant springs. Actually, that's the only way I can describe it, like you would see a half a spring, like a leaf spring. Maybe that's the best way to describe it. He was running on two leaf springs, Dick, over.
I've seen a number of those, and they look like they work very well with proper training. Mayor Bloomberg was interviewed by Channel 4 briefly, and I think he did say all 50 states are represented and 100 countries are represented, something like 39,000 people in that New York City Marathon, which I guess is essentially the biggest one in the world. And I should know, but I don't, what was the name of the female lady who had the sign on her body that said F1, female number one. And she was the first female who came in at the end of the race. In the old days, I guess it was Greta Weiss, but nowadays, who is that female runner who probably has been in quite a significant number of marathons? Over to you, Mel.
Raj, I saw her out in the league. She's from the United Kingdom. And I can't even call her name now.
Looks like the machine timed out in some kind of a funny way without saying it's timing out, and it just come back to life. So we did miss the last 60 seconds of what you said, Mel. I was hearing you on the input, but didn't come through the machine. You might want to repeat. I guess it did say you're not sure of the lady's name. And so if there's anything else you want to repeat for the last 60 seconds, as I said, I heard you on the input, but the machine itself had timed out. K2KEY, K2LIW.
Yeah, I didn't hear a timeout. That's funny. That's right. I just noticed. I can say it just went dead. No, I can't recall her name. That's what I was trying to say. If somebody on frequency can recall her name offhand. But, yeah, there was a lot of groups running. They were newlyweds. They had a marriage ceremony on the way there with a funny thing they had. This lady and this guy were getting married, and they had the priest. He was running along with them and was performing the ceremony during the race, Dick, over.
Wow. Amazing. And by the way, the lady who from England, who was female number one, at the finish of the race, they handed her newborn child, which looks to me like it was less than 1 year of age. So can you imagine giving birth and winning a New York City Marathon in the same year? That is one tough lady.
Okay, and in fact, one of the most outstanding situations there was a gentleman was running, and he said that he's going to run this race no matter what. And 5 weeks ago, he had a severe heart attack, survived a severe heart attack, and had yet the nerve to get out there and run a marathon today, Dick, over.
Wow. Although that sounds brave, unless I misunderstand, that sounds foolhardy. Now, what's called heart attack, some kind of a cardiac-like event, there's a zillion different things you could have. I mean, a person could have a sudden blast of high blood pressure that gives him a cardiac event, you know. He goes into tachycardia and goes into palpitation and all kinds of and lightheadedness and whatever. You can have a cardiac-like event, which is not necessarily damaging. And then if he does something to get control of the causative agent. He might actually have a healthy heart, but it's in a not-so-healthy body that's correctable. But if it really was something like a myocardial infarction, in other words, some kind of a real stenosis blockage type thing, which potentially did damage to the heart muscle, and then after having some medication and intervention, goes and runs a marathon, wow, that sounds on the surface like it's foolhardy, like it could create a significant damage on a system that hasn't yet healed. How was that one explained, Mel, if it was explained at all? Go ahead.
Oh, I don't know. There was one story after another that you heard, you know, about the most unusual situations that were during the race. People doing things that, you know, you'd say impossible, you know, people that... there was one pair that were running. There were three people that were running. The middle person was totally blind, and they had an unusual way they were running. The two people on either side of them were running. They had a string actually attached to their waist, and he was holding on to the string with hands on each side on the string, and this way they were able to guide him. In other words, keep him running, you know, straight on the course by feeling the pulls on the string, Dick, over.
Yeah, there are people with similar techniques have climbed at least a fraction of Everest, done skiing and whatever, sight-impaired people. Unusual. Kind of brave. And with a little help from your friends, I guess a sightless person is not unsighted anymore. Okay, I started looking up weird wires and haven't found anything yet, but I'm going to start looking up Landstorfer, I think it is, and see if I can find the section you're talking about. How was the mailbag this week? K2KEY, K2RIW.
Okay, this is K2KEY. Yeah, Landstorfer. L-A-N-D, S like in Sierra, T-O-R-F. Landstorfer. I remember the name well. Now, how can you forget a name like that? Weird Wires. It was so, you know, attracted me because of this, like I say, the expedition to Peter's One Island, the 3Y0PI expedition that they used his antenna. And they claimed, that's the claim they made, that 3 to 4 dB increase because of the way they twisted something because of his design. No? All right. Anyhow. Mailbag, let me see. Okay, first of all, there's a comment I want to make that a number of people have contacted me. I've had a lot of emails about this subject, about building a very nice piece of equipment, very nice piece of ham equipment. Even though I haven't built this thing exactly from their, you know, start from their kit or whatever you want to call it from the get-go, I have plagiarized, I should say, some of their ideas into one of my rigs and found that they have some very innovative ideas. And I'm talking basically, I wonder if you've ever heard of the Elecraft K2, Dick, over.
Sure have. Among the serious VHF operators who need a very high-performance tunable IF radio to connect to their crystal control converter front ends that gets them from 432, 1296, 235, 10, 24 gigs. That's a K2 and K3, I think it is. Very high-performance, high dynamic range, digital signal processing, software-defined radio type thing. Lots and lots of the serious UHF, SHF operators are into that particular radio, and I believe his latest version of that is drastically back-ordered. Lots of people are demanding that kit or the fully built-up version. How about you, Mel?
Yeah, Roger, there's a problem with the K3 getting the kit. Now, the K3 and the K2 are different quite a bit because the K3, he went into more of a software-defined radio and has a lot more digital processing and things like that in there, and it's not a kit as the K2, actually, you're putting it together component by component, whereas the K3 already has very sophisticated boards in it that are surface-mounted technology, SMT. Can't get away from it, people. And you do not actually build all, you know, put those all those components on board. You're more or less taking the boards and assembling it into and wiring in between, you know, connectors and things that are in between the boards, but not assembling component by component as you did in the K2. Now, there is a problem. I know somebody had ordered one, and it months and months went by. They didn't get it. Canceled the order, Dick. But the point is, the questions are, do you know anyone that has taken on the construction of the K2, over?
Without a doubt. When I was at, in 2007, the last issue of the Microwave Update that took place in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, sponsored by the Mount Airy VHF Society, the so-called pack rats, of those 150 very serious UHF guys there, maybe 180 guys, representing 30-some-odd states and probably 10 countries, the main subject of discussion was software-defined radios, radios that have high dynamic range, digital signal processing-like functions. And after lecture after lecture on the subject of what has been built, what has been done, a number of those guys owned E2, E3s, or K2, K3s, the LE craft radios. A number of those guys owned them, were using them, saying very positive things about them, talking about the back order, and so on. These guys were at the leading edge, so they made sure that they had their order in even before the rest of the world knew that you could order the darn thing. You know, they were talking to the author and making sure their order was in way ahead of the rest of the crowd. But one of the questions I think I mentioned to you, let me drop, was I asked the question of that assembled group, give me your best guess among the serious VHF, UHF operators, SHF operators, what percentage of those guys do you think in the next 5 years will be heavily using software-defined radios? And the answer is considerably more than 50% of the really serious guys will be using software-defined radios within 5 years. So it seems to be the wave of the future. Back to you, Mel.
Okay, we're not going to get beat. All right, now the point is, the question is, did anybody make any comments about building one of these pieces of equipment like the K2? Because I've been getting a lot of questions, and they said that the original review of the K2, they said that this radio, when assembled, is worth in comparison to a radio, compared to a radio that's thousands of dollars more, considerably more, it is favorable to that radio. I don't know how much you know about that, the K2, but I mean, being that you're privy to talk to people there about it, do you think it's a kit that the average amateur radio operator could put together, or somebody would have to be really experienced in building previously, over?
Without a doubt, the kit saves you a lot of money. And among the people who built it, these are fairly skilled operators that the Microwave Update group, if I want to exaggerate a little bit, though, those guys think they are the creme de la creme. You got 600,000 amateur radio operators in the United States. It represents roughly 1 per 1,000 or 1 per 500 human beings in the general population. They're very serious UHF, SHF operators. There's one of them per 1,000 hands. So we're talking about four people per million out of the general population. That's what this particular group seems to be. So among those people, assembling this kit was falling off a log. I think you're asking now, could a person build one of these kits as the very first project? Like you and I built some Heathkit in our early days, and Heathkit was made for the common man. If you could read the English language, if you could read a color code, semi, and if you knew how to do some soldering or could learn how to do soldering, you could put together a Heathkit. The skill of the people who are designing that Elecraft kit, my impression is it could easily be similar to the skill of the people who design the Heathkit kits. So, with a couple of minor errors that are not going to create an explosion, I suspect a guy who's got pretty good dexterity, eyesight, and knows how to follow instructions, I don't think assembling the kit's going to be a problem. It would be a rare individual who would intentionally design a kit that unless you had 10 years of microwave experience, you wouldn't be able to put it together. I don't think the Elecraft company is like that. So, on the assumption you really think you need that receiver and would like to have it and have the resources to buy it, I wouldn't let the degree of difficulty of putting the kit together be an impediment to whether or not I'm going to buy it. I'd go for it. The worst that'll happen is you'll have some difficulty in one particular section. You call up the company and say, what do I do now? You call over your friend who has put together a couple of kits and say, hey, help me get by this particular tough section. I don't think it's a showstopper. I'd go for it. Back to you, Mel.
Okay, this is K2KEY. Well, with Heathkit, it was a situation that technology, of course, was a lot different when Heathkit back. Well, the last years of Heathkit when they did start producing solid-state equipment. But Heathkit always had the motto that we will never let any of our kit builders fail. They had people that you could call on the phone and you tell them the kit that you're putting together, and they were so familiar with that they could actually, by a tone of voice where they're getting stuck, know exactly how to correct it. They were really excellent Heathkits. The difference is the K2, from what I've seen of it and all, is a little bit more sophisticated. I could say it's not undoable, but a little bit more sophisticated than putting together a Heathkit. It requires a little bit more of experience of soldering on printed circuit boards and things of that, that maybe I would say to somebody, try maybe to start out with one of their, they have several kits. I mean, they got a couple of nice 2RP radios and all, and maybe starting out with one of them and see if you can, put together one of those without too much problem. They're fairly reasonably priced. And then maybe move on, if you really want to, go to a very excellent piece of equipment, like you say, the K2, which is highly recommended. Move on to it later on, but I think maybe to get some initial practice, if you haven't attempted anything this so sophisticated previously, kick over.
Okay, yeah, that was a very nice concept that Heathkit had, that no kit builder will fail. And I haven't heard Elecraft make a similar comment. But still, I guess you and I got to be a little bit careful. We do have a number of people who listen to our TechNet who have never opened up the case of their radio and would have great fear of doing so. Maybe don't have tools, don't have experience of using tools, never did soldering. So yes, for those kind of people, a kit like this is a bit of a leap. Among the skilled operators, I don't remember what the number was, but if someone told me it took 200 hours of labor to put the Elecraft kit together, some large number of hours, I would believe it. So it's not a small project. I'll bet you the instruction manual goes on for lots and lots of pages. So maybe I'm a little bit too quick to say, yeah, if you want it, go buy it. However, some of the people who listen to our mail are not poor people. Some of them got a little bit of money they're willing to risk, and they'd like to have something of quality. even though they never put something together. It wouldn't be the end of the world if they got stuck in the middle of a kit and had to ask for help. And for the kind of people that gather at this TechNet, I think they would get that help. K2KEY, K2RW.
I can say I haven't built the entire kit from scratch in K2, but I've looked at the schematics and looked at some of the procedures, and I personally, of course, believe that I get too old, old teens, old timers like us. I don't think we would look at it as a much of a challenge, because I'm sure we've tackled things of this magnitude before, and maybe even lots more difficult on a scale of 1 to 10. I would say that I would put this at maybe a 5 or a 6, no more than that. But I have used, was able to duplicate, basically was looking at the front end of how they went ahead about their front end design and all, which was fairly innovative, I will say, and did put that into a radio I had already, a commercial radio, that was basically very similar, except that it didn't have that front end, and the improvement was immense, I just have to say that. So if you think you can tackle a kit like this, you will save yourself quite a bit of money, and you will have a radio that will last you a lifetime. If anything goes wrong with it, you build it, you'll be able to service it. I think that's really one of the top-notch reasons to do it, if you can, is you have a radio you can always repair yourself, Dick, over.
Agreed. Well, lots and lots of people who built a Heath kit for the reason of being able to repair it themselves had that warm feeling, and it worked. Because they put it together, they feel that that they're emotionally attached to it, and that it's not that much magic, and therefore they're free to open up the case and make modifications and make repairs. But for a guy who buys a modern-day Southeast Asia manufactured high-quality rig, once he gets past the philosophy that if he opens the cover, he's going to void the warranty, there really isn't much of a warranty there in the first place, and there isn't a scorpion inside with a year's supply of food. As long as you follow a couple of reasonable safety procedures, opening up the cover of a commercially made rig is not a big deal. And as long as you make sure that the very first thing you do is measure all the voltages coming out of the power supply before you proceed, if you're doing troubleshooting, have at it. As long as you've got the schematic and know how to read a schematic and have enough dexterity that you're not going to be dropping a screwdriver onto the board while it's operating. You're not going to be putting a voltage probe in the wrong place and shorting wires together. As long as you obey a reasonable amount of safety procedures like that, I don't think there's a great deal of difference of opening up a commercial rig versus opening up the cabinet of one that I put together myself. But that's an opinion for me. A lot of other people think differently. The Elecraft is not cheap. The number of dollars you're going to put into that kit and put it together, in some cases, is not that different from the number of dollars you put into another kind of a fully built Southeast Asia rig of lower performance. So in either case, you're opening up a rig of similar dollar of value. And as long as you don't do anything foolish, I think you can do that in a trouble-free manner. That's what I believe. It's a matter of setting the right attitude and doing a little bit of learning and talking to people ahead of time. K2KEY, K2LAW.
Okay, this is K2KEY, yes, because I've gotten a number of questions here about it. There seems to be a lot of interested people because the price of a good HF radio today is from the initial price of the K2 jumping to even some of the more reasonable rates that are still in the thousands of dollars. In fact, now the comparison radio to it is $7,000. So that's, oh yeah, in fact, I'm looking through here. Questions about winding toroid. you know, because that's what you have to do. You have to wind a number of toroidal type of coils for this radio. And in fact, before I start